My name is Sharon and I serve the village's education lead, and it's my pleasure to introduce Emily Swanson. Emily is a longtime Holdenite, correct?
I came for a January term in college, which is getting to be a long time ago.
Not compared to some of us, but you could say that, right?
Yes.
And then an Easter and a couple summers.
Yeah, very good. So her background, her PhD is in English, so it's a little different perspective, right, as far as wilderness. And she's going to talk about wilderness as a cultural construction. Couple years experience in Glacier as a park ranger, and so she brings lots to the table. So thank you, Emily.
Thank you.
Thanks for introducing me.
So welcome. I'm glad you all chose to come to this session. And I went to graduate school because I thought if I was an English graduate student, I would just get to read novels all the time, and it would be awesome. It turned out it wasn't quite all we did, but I spent a couple summers as a park ranger at Glacier, and I realized that if I couldn't be at Glacier all the time, I could at least read about things related to Glacier, and so that's how I got interested in environmental writers. And my dissertation was on how public policy from the 40s to the present changed, depending on how well environmental writers connected their message to concerns of the time. So that's my background. And wilderness is particularly interesting because it's one of those words that when you hear it, everybody is like, oh, I know what that means. But when you start to say, well, what exactly is wilderness, you realize that different people have different ideas about what it means, and that that idea has, depending on the place or time that you are, can mean very different things to very different people. And so I got some of your names beforehand. I'll hopefully get to know more of you. I'm focused mainly on Western traditions because it's a very Western idea. So from the Bible till now, it's really changed. And Holden is a really great place to think about wilderness because we are situated in wilderness and it affects things we do every day. And they even talk about how it's a place that welcomes all people of goodwill who seek contemplation and community in the remote wilderness of the beautiful Cascade Mountains. So it's very much integral to who we are. And so what I would like you to do is answer the questions. If you had to define wilderness, how would you define it? And then also think about what experiences have shaped how you understand what wilderness is, because everybody has a different background as to how they've come to understand what wilderness is. I'll give you a little time to think about it. I personally think best when I have a pencil in my hand. So I have this very fancy modern paper that you might recognize, and I have some pencils. So I'll give you a little time to just on your own define what is wilderness and how has that definition been shaped by your experiences. Okay, so how do you define wilderness? Yeah.
I said wilderness is a wild area kept in its natural state. However, Native Americans have been removed from these areas and some form of fauna who lived in the area, such as grizzly bear.
Okay, so it's an area kept in its natural state, and indigenous people and animals may have been removed. What else?
We thought of it as a remote place.
Remote. What else?
Wild, like the name says, wild place.
Wild. Can I put you on the spot and ask you to define wild?
I've broken up on this stuff, but it's like where non-human animals feel at home.
Oh, okay.
And act out in their real rooms.
Ah, okay, so non-human animals are at home and undisturbed in their rhythms. Right. Good. What else?
In the United States, there's an area where you can have no power equipment or any type of vehicle.
Good. So according to the Wilderness Act, you can't have vehicles or power equipment. Good. What else?
There's an inherent risk.
There's
potential injury, weather, animals, dumb accidents.
potential for danger, and you were going to say?
I said a place of simplicity and essentialness as opposed to frivolity and clutter.
Okay, so simplicity uncluttered. Good. These are great. What else? Yeah.
Place to wander and seek understanding.
Okay. Yeah.
Very similar to what other people are saying with one addition. To me, it's not a desert. It's a wooded, or I grew up in the Northwest, and to me, I wouldn't think of wilderness as being a desert. It's, don't I have trees?
But I think there is desert that's wilderness.
I went so far as to put the sea to be wilderness as well.
That, yeah, it is, depending on who you are and where you're from, different places qualify and other places don't. So I think the Everglades was the first swamp to be included. Most, we'll get to what types of land were wilderness, but that is important.
For me, it's a place with few or no signs of human habitation.
Yeah. All right.
And that could be a desert or woods.
So this is related, but a little different. So there's no human habitation, whether it's indigenous people or other. You don't go there to see other people's garbage. You go there to see the natural spaces. Good. Any other? Yeah.
It's a little long.
It's okay.
In the pure form, not much wilderness remains. Areas untouched or modified by human intrusion. I suppose that commonly wilderness is an area essentially low in human interference and areas left for a long time to return to its natural state as perhaps changed by human interaction.
Yes. So if it can't be pure and untouched, at least it's been left alone for a long time after it has been touched. Good. Any other? Doing a great job. Yeah.
Kind of been touched on a little bit, but like solitude and isolation, I think for me.
Yeah. I worked at Glacier way back in 2000, I have to think about this, 2003, and I went back to visit on my way out here. And Glacier is probably the place I am happiest in the world. And I was like, I wouldn't recommend anyone come here. It is so crowded. When I was there, visitation almost got to 2 million. Last year it was 3 million. And this June was 28% higher than last June. So there is this sense of you don't want to be traipsing down the trail with a million other people. Good. Other, you should still go to Glacier. It's still beautiful.
There more than 100 years.
Good. And what kind of experiences have you had that shaped these definitions that we got?
Kind of most of the time the opposite. Asphalt, infrastructure, cars.
Where we live most of the
contrast, yeah. And then the brief times in what was just described. So that contrast.
Yeah,
I grew up in through a Boy Scout group that did overnight weekend camping, one every month, all year round. Seattle was our starting point. And so it was rain and sleeping in tents while it was muddy out and cold. And I just always took a identity with Native Americans as what white man has done to their lifestyle and their taking away their property and everything else, and how if it had just left the way it had been, it'd be a different place. And then Hola Village over the last 35 years since I've been coming up here, it's just, I love this wilderness around this place.
Mm-hmm. Other experiences, are those similar to what?
BWCA.
Boundary Waters.
National Parks.
National Parks.
Canyons.
Camping with your family, maybe? Yeah, what were you going to say, Kat?
Dog sledding in the Yukon.
Dog sledding? Wow. And Richie, what were you going to say?
Reading, media, education, and then also some of my own planning to go out into the wilderness, shape our music.
Yeah, so we've been, what we read about, what we do in nature, what's appropriate, and then definitely media. And then you said your own planning and research?
Yeah.
And I think many of us have experienced these things either with scouting or family or church groups, right? There's somebody who kind of takes you to those places and shows you how to act and what to do while you're there. Good. So our definition, in many ways, is a very American definition of what it means to be in wilderness. And we'll talk a little bit about how we got there. So I want to start with the, with the Bible. So William Cronin, he teaches at University of Wisconsin-Madison. He, it's actually a really awesome book. In the 1990s, they convened a whole bunch of people who write about wilderness, really, in at UC Irvine, and they all contributed a chapter to this book. And he wrote, it's called Uncommon Ground, but his essay is The Trouble with Wilderness. And he talks about how wilderness is a changing idea. And so he points out that we think of wilderness as something apart from humanity, right? It's not where we go to see other people's messes or houses. But it's a human creation made by certain people and certain cultures at very particular moments in human history. And so it's not that we are in charge of the wilderness, but the very idea of setting apart spaces where people don't go is American. That really came through our experiences with the frontier and some other things that we'll get to. And so when you think about the Bible and what wilderness in the Bible is, it's really different than how we think of the Bible. And I'm not a biblical scholar. I suspect many of you are much more well-versed in this than I am. So it'd be nice if you could talk to your neighbors and together come up with some, what is wilderness in the Bible like? Just some descriptions of what happens in wilderness in the Bible. How do people feel about it in the Bible? Who goes there? So introduce yourself to your neighbor and brainstorm. All right, it sounds like you've had some good ideas. And so since I'm not a biblical scholar, I do need your help with this part. So what did you come up with for wilderness and the Bible?
Desert-like, barren.
Yes.
Isolated.
I have to write smaller. So it's a desert, it's barren.
Yep.
What was the other thing?
Isolated.
What else? Lack of food and water.
Lack of food and water.
You talked about how it's a place to go and wake up and be tested.
Yes. So to be awoken, but that often includes a test, right? Where you... I won't say more. Yeah, Heather.
Yeah, just in terms of encounters with God, so either experiences of worship or also of punishment, thinking of plagues.
Mm.
Worship being, you know, the tabernacle and also prayer.
Good.
Yeah, it's sort of a sabbatical in some of the cases where it's basically being with God and learning and growing and in a relationship.
Who do you meet there besides God?
The devil.
The devil. So you could meet God, but you might also meet the devil.
Or yourself.
What else do you have for this part?
I said a place of few distractions.
Yes. It's sort of with that purity. Things are distilled down to the most important ideas.
There's a part of this, I think it's in Hosea, where it's romanticized that when Israel was in the wilderness, forget about the fact we had no food and water, but wasn't it wonderful when it was just God and us? You know, it was just the two of us, and it was like a honeymoon period. But then when they get to the land of plenty in Canaan, then all the other gods are there, all these distractions, these other lovers that they suddenly, oh, there are other, you know, potential lovers now. And but back in the wilderness, there were no options. It was just the two of us. And, oh, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, there's some nostalgia.
Yeah.
Like, it was so great. Yeah, are people going there willingly?
No, sometimes not. Jesus gets driven into the wilderness.
Yep. It's like you are forced to go there. Jesus, the Israelites, and some people identified the picture. Who is this?
That's Hagar.
Hagar and Ishmael. And so you can see the angel coming, but they've been cast out. They're going to die of thirst, right? Before that angel gets here, right? They've been thrown out, away from everybody else. So there are times, I mean, you can wrestle with God there. You can have these intensely spiritual experiences without distraction. But it is also a very scary place to be. People are not throwing on their backpacks and going for a day hike. They are being thrown out of their community. It's scary. So for a long time in Western thought, wilderness is barren, it's desolate, it's a wasteland. You don't want to be there. And you might look on it nostalgically after, oh, wasn't it great when? But most of the time it is frightening. You're away from your community. And I think this idea about meeting God or having this spiritual experience, it's still with us. It's why many of us come to the wilderness. And we know that there's risk. But it's not the kind of risk that they're facing in the wilderness. Ours is a much more controlled risk. And so the idea about wilderness being so awful and scary begins to change. And Edmund Burke's, it's a really long book. It's called The Philosophical Inquiry into the Origin of Our Ideas on the Sublime and the Beautiful. It was published in 1757. But his ideas about the sublime were really important to us. Okay, there we go. Okay, backward in time.
Some things that move us are beautiful, others are sublime. But the sublime moves us more profoundly than the beautiful. That's what the 18th century thinker Edmund Burke claimed in his book, A Philosophical Inquiry into the... But what did he mean? Beautiful objects, he observed, tend to be small, smooth, delicate, and attractive. Sublime ones, vast, gloomy, dark, and threatening. A bluebell, a greyhound, or a doll might be beautiful. A cliff face, a mountain, or a thunderstorm at sea, sublime. Beautiful things produce pleasurable feelings. Sublime ones overwhelm us and are terrifying. They affect us viscerally, but at some level, almost paradoxically. Are frightened, but manage to feel a kind of delight in our experience despite the danger. A huge waterfall could engulf us, but at some level that's part of its appeal. The sheer power is exhilarating. Burke thought the reason why the sublime moves us so deeply pain, and so triggers basic feelings of self-preservation. When we experience the sublime, we exercise the nerves that could save our lives in a genuinely threatening situation. This idea of the sublime had a powerful influence on Romanticism, the artistic movement that extolled the untamed power of the natural world.
The sublime, it's that scare, the intense fear. I think extreme sports, you're encountering the sublime. It's fun because you could get hurt. And so this is really popular in 18th century England. People start to seek out experiences where they go on the grand tour and they want to see big mountains and they want to experience that sort of intense power. And art starts to change a little bit. So not nature is no longer totally scary. It might be scary, but people are enjoying it. It's fun to be there. It's from 1817, so you can see 60 years after Edmund Burke's treatise, it's becoming part of how people are experiencing wilderness and nature. Right? He's all dressed up in fancy, so he wants to be there. So when you think about the sublime and how it's affected how we think about wilderness, what kind of places or types of places fit the sublime? And you were touching on that with woods versus desert. And then Do the places in the United States that fit the sublime fit with ideas about wilderness? So I'll give you just a minute or two to think about that. All right, so what U.S. places are sublime?
Yellowstone.
Good.
Grand Canyon.
Excellent.
Mount Rainier.
Yosemite.
Denali.
Yep. Oh my
goodness. Oceans.
The oceans. Yes. There's an ocean.
The teacups.
Yeah.
Lake Superior.
That's an interesting one. Yeah, you're right.
The Everglades.
Everglades. Although not in the, I mean, I agree, but they're not vast in the way that Burke would think
right.
about it. That's kind of a latecomer. So you've basically,
Colorado's whitewater rafting area.
Ah, Colorado. So rivers. Think of any particularly famous.
Niagara Falls.
There you go. And Niagara Falls, the first couple to elope there, if you're Hamilton fans, was Aaron Burr's daughter. Went on her honeymoon. They were the first couple to honeymoon at Niagara. So that's about the right time, right, for this to trickle down to the United States. So we've got big rivers, big mountains, places that you stand in awe, like, wow, that's amazing. And so, right, Yosemite was the first park. It got national protection. It's a little weird how it happened. It was in 1864, and it got federal protection, but it remained a state place. So that's why some people say Yellowstone was the first park. That was, I think, 1872. But it's debatable how you count it. And then, right, you kind of go down the list, and then later places like the Everglades get protection. And deserts don't get protection until much later in our history of wilderness. So these places, it takes us a while to appreciate them as wilderness because they're not that idea of the sublime. Good, exactly. So it's like all our national parks right there, pretty much. And another thing that influenced wilderness is the Industrial Revolution and the Romantics. The Romantics were absolutely influenced by the idea of the sublime. But about the same time is when Britain industrialized. And I'm not sure how well you'll be able to see this, and I promise not to read the whole thing. But the British Industrial Revolution really starts in the 1770s. That's when the first water power mill was happening. And interestingly enough, the Wealth of Nations is 1776. So how our economy is becoming sort of a capitalist system is happening about the same time. And by 1800, they passed the Combination Acts, where if you destroyed a loom, it was a capital crime. You would be put to death for destroying a loom in a mill. So you don't mess with people's money, right? We're industrializing. We are making people work in factories. The commons have been eradicated so that you no longer have a place necessarily to live in the country. Masses of people are moving to cities. And it's not pretty, right? You work for very little money. It's illegal to collectively... Oh, whoops. The Combination Acts were anti-union, which is interesting because I grew up in Wisconsin and they've just passed some anti-union legislation. But the destruction of stocking frames was the... You can't break a loom. And by 1800, 10 million tons of coal were mined in Great Britain. So things are changing, and they're changing really fast. And it's very ugly. At the same time, the British Romantics are right after that. That's sort of happening at the same time. William Wordsworth and Coleridge are writing about rustic places, the beautiful, simple people in the country. It's so lovely, right? They're not in the city. Suddenly we appreciate that rustic, pastoral landscape. Shelley wrote about Mont Blanc, and he talks about, it's almost exactly the Sublime. The deep and powerful feelings, excited, thank you, by the objects. So he sees Mont Blanc and he's experiencing the Sublime. British Romanticism, it's very, not only are they interested in landscapes, they're interested in how people feel about them. It's all about the poet's reaction to those landscapes. And they're never having these, oh, I felt so excited when I was in the slum, right? It's never that sort of ugly place. We're celebrating the places that we think of as not being wild or beautiful or pastoral anymore. So those things are all happening. And the American frontier is closing about the same time. So this is John Guest's American Progress from 1872. And they printed these out and gave them to people. So if you were moving west, you could get a copy of this picture. And I love that she's stringing telegraph wire as she goes. And it sort of matches how her dress is somehow not falling off of her. Amazing. So what's happening in the picture?
Miners.
Yeah.
Which is movement.
All the movement is west.
All the movement is west. Good.
Manifest destiny.
Manifest destiny. It is our destiny that we are going to come take this land.
In the India, the Native Americans are fleeing.
Yeah.
They are fleeing.
Running for their mind.
They're afraid of either the white people or the progress. The way I've read about it is they're supposedly afraid of progress.
West of her, the clouds are very dark still.
Yeah.
Yes. We are bringing our enlightened society to the West and making it.
Is the book what you would think? Is it the Bible? Or?
I don't think it's the Bible. I was actually trying to figure that out the other day. I should know, but I don't know. It's not the Bible, though.
Is that supposed to be an angel, or just a...
I think she's Colombiana, and she is representing sort of Western ideal culture. And it's very American. She's got the star. Okay, so who gets to be here?
White people.
White men. Right? I mean, she's symbolizing the beauty and the goodness, but the people who are coming, it's very much white men who are...
And domesticated animals.
And domesticated animals. Yes, the buffalo are getting... We don't need those anymore. We're bringing our livestock. This is a really powerful idea. I mean, you don't hand out something that's not a powerful idea to people who are moving west. This is... It's a really big part of our historical culture. I'm sure many of you heard about Frederick Jackson Turner and the closing of the frontier in the 1890s, but that idea was already he didn't come up with the idea, he popularized the idea. So people are starting to get worried about what's gonna happen to our nation and who we are when we don't have this frontier anymore. We don't want to be like civilized, sissy Europe. We want to be tough frontiers people. So as people start to realize the frontier and that wilderness is not, it's a finite thing. There's not enough for it to go on forever. It became a rejuvenating place for elite males. So this is from Cronin. If the frontier was passing, then men who had the means to do so should preserve for themselves some remnant of its wild landscape so that they might enjoy the regeneration and renewal that came from sleeping under the stars, participating in blood sports, and living off the land. The frontier might be gone, but the frontier experience could still be had if wilderness were preserved. So a lot of kind of East Coast wealthy people, think Roosevelt, they want to preserve landscapes so that they can keep this part of them. And it's interesting that it is the very people who are the capitalists who are in some ways creating the destruction of this landscape who get to go enjoy it in preserves. Wilderness becomes a place for recreation and not productive labor. The things we do in wilderness, oh, I erased that part, right, we hike, we camp, we play. but we don't work in wilderness. And this gets to the 1980s when you have environmentalists who don't work in the woods and loggers, right? There's a cultural divide there. A lot of times the environmental movement sort of denigrates people who work in wilderness as bad. They're destroying the wilderness, even as we don't see, oh, I use paper and I build a house and I, you know, all these things that we participate in. So wilderness gets shaped as this place where we go play. And then it's also seen as uninhabited. We mentioned how the indigenous people get pushed off and people don't live there. So like in Glacier, there are a few families who still have cabins that have been passed down, but when it, if they can't pass it on through their family, those will go back to the park. So you can't live there unless you got granddaddied in. And eventually that will end. And so I think it's really important. I don't know, if my movie doesn't work, we won't suffer through it. But it's important to think about how populated the Americas were when Europeans arrived, and it's kind of startling to think about. So this film shows over time lapse how indigenous peoples have been pushed out. And so the idea that wilderness is an empty place is still really pervasive, right? They were untouched lands. And we forget to see how they weren't. Like, people were living there. And when I am going to bore you with all my Glacier stories. But when I was there, I ran into a friend that I worked with. And he now is one of the police rangers. And he lives on the east side, which borders the Blackfeet Reservation. And it's their land that got stolen to become Glacier. And his son is 11, and he's like, yeah, we're moving to the west side because I don't want my son to go to school. He would end up in school on the reservation as the child of a law enforcement officer because he'll have a target on his back. And so even now there's this contentious relationship with whose land is it and who gets to use it.
So I had a question. Yeah. I heard from Native Americans in 1491, the book, 80 to 90% of the natives were already gone. They were dead from disease, from the trade routes. So they, you know, they'd already been wiped out when we got here. And that's the reason we could probably win. I mean, that's just my
opinion. No, actually, we'll talk about it a little bit if you come to the session on Wednesday or Friday. But it's astonishing how many million people died. Some of it was through killing, but some of it was just disease. I mean, it was millions and millions of people who got.
That was after 1492.
After 1492. Yeah. You're saying with the.
Yeah, with the trade routes and diseases, their immune systems aren't the same as Europeans, and they couldn't handle just measles would kill them.
Right.
Or anything.
Yeah, that is true. But there are, I mean, like I'm thinking about Yellowstone, Yosemite Glacier. Yeah. There were Indian people living there who got booted out. So when you get to the Wilderness Act of 64, they really put it, the Wilderness Act got pushed starting in post-World War II. How are our young men going to be manly and American if they don't have these places preserved where they can go camp and hunt and do manly American things? And the definition that they came up with is a wilderness, in contrast with those areas where man and his works dominate the landscape, is hereby recognized as an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled, and untrammeled means like unconstrained, where man in himself is a visitor who does not remain. So the very definition of wilderness for our nation is people aren't there, we just visit. And then also it has opportunities for solitude or a primitive and confined type of recreation. So that we go play there. We don't stay there, we play. And it's very much shaped our definition today. And somebody said remote, and the original definition had to be more than 5,000 acres, which in many ways made it remote, and there couldn't be roads there. And since then, they have designated some smaller areas as wilderness, but it... your definition that we came up with together is very much how it is codified in U.S. law, right? It's a natural state. Nobody gets to live there. It's remote. The animals might be gone. We're hopefully seeing some megafauna return. And it's definitely risky if you are, you know, we know that being here, if something happened. My mom didn't come this time because the last time we were here, she had had a heart attack before we got here, and she saw somebody airlifted out in a helicopter for cardiac emergencies, and she's like, I'm not going back ever. It's too much. So there is a risk with being here. So our definition and the American federal definition are very much similar. And that shows up in our how we appreciate and visualize art today. And so Bierstadt's Valley of Yosemite, which happened to be the same year that it got protection, the whole reason the valley was unforested because of the Indians who were living there, but in his picture they've been removed. You don't see their homes. And that, I love Ansel Adams, so this is not at all slamming these artists. But this is what we think of when we think of wilderness, right? We don't see the gas station near the park that allows us to enjoy the park. The road, you know, the roads are not pictured. Our vision is very much related to our definition of what it is. And in many ways, that's all well and good. But Cronin points out that when we have an idealized wilderness, it often means not idealizing the environment in which we actually live, the landscape that, for better or worse, we call home. Most of our most serious environmental problems start right here at home, and if we are to solve these problems, we need an environmental ethic that will tell us as much about using nature as not using it. So the wilderness dualism, so it's either wilderness or we've trashed it because we live there, tends to cast any use as abuse and thereby denies us a middle ground in which responsible use and non-use might attain some kind of balanced, sustainable relationship. So it's okay that, you know, the sprawl around Minneapolis is there because I can always get away to the boundary waters or I can go somewhere else. And so if people can't be in wilderness, it means that anywhere we are is bad. And we're not bad. We want to live and we want to use things. And so how do you have this idea of wilderness and still have a healthy, respectful respect toward the nature in which we actually live? So that brings me, this is the part where I want your answers, because has your definition of wilderness changed? And if it did, how? In what ways do Cronin's arguments challenge our ideas of wilderness here at Holden? Holden is a really exceptional place because it's one of the few places where there are, in my mind, where there are people that are not trashing the place that they are, right? All of our garbage comes up, it all goes down lake. It gets, well, that's also sort of a problem. But we are more thoughtful about what we use here and how we use it. And then these two are the questions that I wish I had some magic answer for. So some of the I don't want to pitch the idea of wilderness. They're places that I like to go. They're places that I think deserve protection and shouldn't be mined or trashed. Is there a way we can define wilderness that allows for a human presence or allows us to be places, live places, but still enable preservation? Right? Getting rid of the Wilderness Act could be a terrible thing because those places will get trash. But how do we have the idea of wilderness but a more healthy relationship at home? So think about that. And then are there new definitions of wilderness that allow for protections of God's creation? As Christians, are there ways that we can think about wilderness in a more healthy way? And so I'm not going to let you off the hook with saying, go away, but actually think about this. Whether you do it individually or in groups, I don't care, but I am curious about your thoughts. So take a few minutes, and whichever question appeals most to you, go for it. So what have you got? What appealed to you? What do you think about it?
Okay.
So I think my definition of wilderness changed. I mean, it's been pointed out that it's really a product of wealthy cowboy, I mean, wealthy males who want to maintain their virility. That changes my mind a lot. And actually what it makes me think is that instead of using them as a place to escape, why don't we think about making the places where we live appreciable, you know, like we'd like to be there.
Could you speak up so we
can hear? So it says to me that we need to make places where we live and spend most of our time actually enjoyable and sustainable instead of escaping to places where it's really cool. Because we're not going to make it, for one thing, unless we do that. And the other thing is, it smacks to me that human beings are a little bit better than everything else. Mm. We can use nature however we want to. Animals don't matter. We can do whatever we want to them. I think that's very arrogant. And we're right now looking at the price for that kind of thinking. Climate, you know, nature doesn't care. Climate change is going to come back on us.
Well, I think one place I really feel that's not true is Alaska. It's so much of it is roadless and remote, and I just feel like, when I think of Alaska as opposed to any place else in the lower 48, it feels like scary to me, like that you were going back to that gloomy and scary thing. I feel like it's a place where you can die very easily. Just because there's not, help is not there, because there's just so few people.
A change in my definition of wilderness, just as we're going through it, is I added to it, wilderness is really only allowed for the privileged.
Mm-hmm.
And the privileged are making a mess of it when you look at the lines going up to Mount Everest and the oxygen bottles and the refuse and the things that people aren't bringing back.
The dead bodies.
It's horrifying.
And with the increasing population that we're experiencing over the next few years, lots of our national parks now are restricted on the amount of people that can go in, and you can no longer drive through Weiss, Zion, and you go by bus. And this is also true in Yosemite now. You can no longer go, and I remember when we went through Yosemite before, you kept driving and driving just to find a place to park. There's so much traffic in these areas. But I'm for multiple use in lots of our wilderness area, because there's only about 2-3% of our population ever uses lots of this wilderness area. But if it's correctly maintained and supervised, I think that lots of us older people that, you know, used to walk and hike way back in no man's land can enjoy it.
Yeah, the idea of access is important, that wilderness in some ways acts, and it's a place for people who are privileged but also able-bodied, right?
Yeah.
It's hard to experience wilderness if you are not able-bodied. Yeah.
I'm going to tail on to something that Clara said. I want to see a management program of the wilderness areas so that they can become recreation places as well as solid places of solitude. Because I feel if we don't get to know the wilderness, if we don't encourage people to get out there and they don't love it, they're not going to care for it.
Yeah.
I'm just struck by this notion of, it seems like when we create an abstraction of something, so, you know, this is a place where that's separate from our normal way of our normal daily living, you know, just thinking of the trashing of Everest, it's like there's this attraction to it, and then instead of, even in our appreciation of it, we end up trashing it or we end up creating a monster. Like, I was just sharing last week when they talked about the era of mega fires, you know, he talked about how our response to fire over the century has been to suppress and suppress and suppress. And what we've done in that suppression, in that reaction, is that we've created an era of mega fires, which are totally out of control and are burning, you know, uncontrollably. And we've like created this monster. Mm-hmm. So I'm just drawn to that notion of like, what does it mean to live with something and to seek some kind of integration so we don't destroy it and not like by accident, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. And it's the idea that we shouldn't touch it, we shouldn't do anything
right
to it, does lead to this, oh, now there's too many fuels built up, it's dangerous. But I think the question lies in how much and what kind of management
right
takes. Like, we have to be really careful with that, because we can pretty easily ruin a place if we start using it however we like. And the idea that, I mean, other people have talked about how we're loving our parks to death, where it's great that we love it, and we need people to love it. The environmental movement will be in very, very dismal shape if people don't care and don't have experiences in nature that make them want to care. But that balance is really tricky. And I should add, I love wilderness. So even though I'm pointing out that it is a cultural abstraction that doesn't always come from the prettiest of places, I still think it has value. I still think the idea is important. I do think we have to be careful about all these things that you've brought up. And that is the tricky part. And the idea about making our everyday places healthier, like, how can we get wilderness to feed into the, you know, the idea of, I appreciate this place that is not seeing the same human impacts, but the tree in my yard is still nature and it is still beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily our culture's way of appreciating things. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how we get to this place, but like the thing that I'm thinking about is like from reading some of Daniel Quinn's novels, he points out that, you know, our cultural myth is that the world was made for man and man was made to conquer the world. And it's like we just have to change that whole mindset, and that just seems like an overwhelmingly impossible thing. But I mean, it just seems like, not to be doomsday or anything, but it just seems like, how else are we going to get from point A to point B unless we change that mega myth?
Yeah, it's easy for me to say, let's just adopt this new attitude, and we have these extreme ways of thinking that are thousands of years old. And I think capitalism plays into, right? We make money at all costs and we externalize any pollution, any badness, that's somebody else's problem. I can emit as much carbon as I like because it's my right to do so. And so that is another, I'm not advocating revolution, but there, something has, maybe I am. But clearly we need some sort of change in our thinking.
Yeah.
But also we lost, like somebody mentioned, forest management. The Native Americans did that.
Oh, yeah.
And they took care of their forests and took care of the underbrush, and they didn't have these huge fires.
Right.
So we lose things by taking over another culture. And we, you know, we think we know better, and lots of times we don't.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I know that it's getting close to dinner, and I don't want to hold you captive. So if you want, I really appreciate your being here and sharing your ideas. If you want to continue to talk, we can do so. But if you want to go eat, you are absolutely welcome to. So thanks.
Thank you.